Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. It's March 7th, 2022. Wish I could say I was gearing up to watch some spring training baseball games, but I'm not, and you're not either. Oh well, good thing you could listen to The Drop.
It is March 7th. There is no spring training. The NBA season is heating up. March Madness is right around the corner, which means that this is the only time of the year I will watch college basketball. live music is just happening, and it's as if it's just happening, and there's no thought otherwise. It's just happening. Masks are coming off, but there's still a lot of shit happening in this world in a way that is very tragic and sad. And for that, I feel like we're just existing still. We're going through life as we know it. You know what I mean, Dave?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's still going through the motions. I think America and the world at large can't seem to catch a break for very long.
No. I imagine this is what it, in some cases, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I imagine in some cases this is what it was like for our grandparents growing up and just being like, well, this is just living. And the sensations that we had and the concerns that we had between 1990 and 2015, 25-year period where things just kind of like worked for this part of the world. Fleeting at this point in time.
Something like that.
We also here at The Drop, I promise we're going to get into some good stuff here, but we have some somber news to share with the listeners out here. This will be, relatively speaking, I should say, this will be the final episode of the Dave and Brian Drop. We are going to take a step back following this episode.
And another step back.
And another step back. And just another step back.
People up here getting crushed.
Their eyes are popping out of their head, you know? There's some internal moving and shaking here at Osiris Media. We have a show that we will potentially be announcing debuting here in this episode, maybe a little bit later this week, depending on how a few things go. But there's another show that's going to be debuting in our place, taking over the weekly cycle of new music, live music, reviews, what's happening in the world sort of thing, that will be launching here towards the end of March. So we're going to be shuttering our doors for some time here, taking a breather, taking a step back again, and perhaps we'll be back at some point in the not too distant future in a different set of podcasting clothes. We'll see. We've got some ideas, some thoughts in the not too distant future, but for now we're going to take a pause, get back to just kind of enjoying music on our own, utilizing our text chain to be our podcast, and you know, not sharing our thoughts with you on a week-to-week basis. Any thoughts on it, Dave, or did I say it all?
Yeah, you basically covered everything. I absolutely enjoyed doing the drop for the period of time that we did it. Enjoyed sharing our ideas and thoughts, bringing that checks chain to life on every Monday morning to you people. But like you said, I don't think this is the end. If everything falls into place, we should be back in some way, shape, or form in the not too distant future. But yeah, we're going to take a bit of a pause this spring. And I know for a fact that what's going to be essentially replacing the drop is going to be very good. You'll be in excellent hands.
Absolutely. So we're going to do a pretty normal episode here just because, you know, we've only been doing the drop for about 9 or 10 months at this point in time. And we want to just kind of give you an update on terms of where we are. Some podcasts that we continue to recommend, some records that we've been listening to, as well as the middle part of this episode, our big discussion focuses on one of our favorite young bands in the entire world, not just America, not just England, possibly Australia, hint, 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 hint. We have thoughts about said band who has returned with, I don't even know what record this is at this point in time. It's record number 2 for me because their last record was the one that got me. I think this is their 3rd or 4th record at this point.
Third album.
We're going to talk about Gang of Youths. Why am I hiding behind this? We're going to talk about Gang of Youths midway through this episode. But before we do that, Dave, what is happening in your life? What's going on music-wise? What's happening sports-wise? Tell me where you're at.
Well, more like what's not happening in my life, which is baseball is not happening in my life. It's not happening in your life. It's not happening in the life of anybody in America right now because yesterday there was the announcement from Major League Baseball that they can't come to an agreement on the new collective bargaining agreement, so the owners, Rob Manfred, has decided to cancel the first 2 weeks of the season, which was supposed to start on March 31st. Now it won't start till the middle of June at the soonest. And April at the soonest. I have a feeling it's not going to start much later after that. I think we'll be lucky if the season starts in June, if we get a season at all, because both sides are really digging in. And I would say 100% on the side of the players at this point who don't want to be getting pushed around. And, right now, I think next to probably Ted Cruz, Rob Manfred might be the person I most want to throw down a flight of stairs. For he is smug, and he's not negotiating in good faith. And for somebody who's the commissioner of baseball, I'm not sure that he actually understands or even enjoys the game of baseball. Because if he did, it would have never come to the point where we're canceling games the regular season. He's basically holding water for the owner class, all of who are ridiculously wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. And for any owner of a baseball team to cry poverty is quite the lie. So, obviously you can tell I have some feelings about where the baseball season is headed.
Yeah, you know, I think the only nit I would pick, I agree with everything you said, is I don't... and I don't think you intended it this way, but like, I don't think that they can't come to an agreement. I think the owners are just straight up negotiating in horrible faith,
right,
and trying to push bullshit arguments on the sports loving populace that we've already found in past negotiations, regardless of the sport that it is, to be completely false. The last time I listened to any arguments from an owner and thought maybe they have a good point was the 2011-2012 NBA lockout, when certain NBA teams were at risk of contraction. They were not making money, and they were making the argument, falsely, but they were making the argument that could be believed and bought by the sports media, that they did need some sort of competitive balance, that they did need some sort of a reset to help struggling franchises in New Orleans, in Memphis, in Oklahoma City, what have you.
Sacramento.
What we saw over the following 5 years in the NBA was an unprecedented growth in profits and an unprecedented growth for the game. And by 2016, they had so much goddamn money that Kevin Durant ended up on the 73-win Golden State Warriors. That was the last time I would ever listen to any sort of argument from a fucking sports team's owner and say, actually, you might be making some sense here. Baseball has made money continuously, even as majority of the country turns away from baseball and says, it's too long, it's too slow, I just don't care, I don't know what's happening, why does a pitcher take 27 seconds to throw a goddamn pitch, why can't batters hit singles anymore because the entire game is rigged against singles hitters, why are the Houston Astros awarded a World Series championship when they blatantly cheated to get there. Most of the country doesn't care about baseball anymore. It's like local fan bases and you and I and our buddy Josh Carver. Like, that is the baseball loving fan base at this point in time. And yet the game continues to make money, and they're arguing now,
made $10.7 billion last year.
Yeah. Like, They're arguing to expand the playoffs, which is the one thing I really agree with. I think that it's a good thing for the game. I don't think that it's a good thing that last year the Seattle Mariners and Toronto Blue Jays missed the playoffs. I think it would have been a good thing for the Reds and the Phillies to have made the playoffs based on the way that they were playing towards the end of the season. I'm in agreement that the universal DH is probably a good thing because there's really no reason why we should have one batter that just doesn't matter every time an NL team comes up to the plate. I agree with all those things. I see the rationale for that to help continue to increase the game. What they are trying to do to the players is absolutely bullshit beyond that. I'm at a point now where I would rather there be no baseball than the owners to win. And that's a really sad place to be.
I'm leaning towards that way. On the one hand, I kind of hope that doesn't happen, only because I very much enjoy going to see baseball games in the summer. I enjoy watching them on my couch. I'll sit for 3 hours and just veg out and watch a baseball game. It's music to my ears. I'll look at my phone. I'll listen to some music. I'll do some work. As long as the baseball game's on, it's like a comfort. Baseball is a babysitter. It's how I've lived my life. It's what I've watched my whole life. It's what my grandparents watch. It's what my father watch. I mean, to me, there's nothing better than just watching a game on the couch with my dad. That's like what I live for doing. I hope one day my children will enjoy doing it the same way with me. But yeah, at this point, the bargaining has been in such bad faith to get see Rob Manfred up on the podium smiling and even giggling, basically saying, oh, we tried everything we could do to help the fans because this is the best thing possible thing for the fans. Saying he gives a fuck about the fans is so incredibly disingenuous and insults my intelligence. It's just, I can't watch that. It's like no different than watching, I don't know, I don't want to talk about my least favorite politicians in Congress because I don't want to even give them the airtime, but it felt like watching a really disingenuous member of like the Republican Party get up there and try to say that they love America.
No, it feels the exact same way. And especially since, like, you go back to December 2nd, I was watching MLB tonight that night, And every single person to a T, and you knew it as a fan, was looking at him imposing the lockout as, you did this, dude. Mm. Like, you just did this. This is not, it's not that you can't come to an agreement. You just did this to try to punish the players. And the people who are going to be punished are going to be the fans who are not going to watch. But I don't think he realizes the next 3 months, so where it's March 2nd when we're recording, let's call it the next 4 months. Sports fans can get by without baseball. We've got March Madness coming up. We've got the NBA season heating up. This is the best time of year to watch the NBA. The NHL season is heating up. NBA, NHL playoffs can dominate everything that you do as a sports fan in April, May, and June. July is kind of a dead zone month, but like, there's going to be new movies out. There are concerts. There are things that people are going to be leaving the house to go and do. August, NFL preseason starts up. September, NFL starts up.
NFL is like, practically year-wide at this point. Between the draft, between the combine, the NFL has gotten extremely good at marketing themselves as, even when the games aren't on, there's like enough to keep one's interest throughout.
Well, and to that point, July, the NBA has free agency and a ton of player movement. Like, my point is, if baseball thinks that they can survive, like, 2 weeks will be one thing. I'll forgive them if they come back in April and I'll watch baseball. If baseball doesn't come back until June or July, like, out of spite, I may just not watch this just to, like, I don't want to give any money to these fucking pieces of shit owners. And to me, what they are risking, they think that there is a clock that needs to run based on baseball. And there is for people like you and I. And this will be really hard from a sports standpoint, to go a year without baseball, to go 6 months without baseball. I don't think that they realize that the majority of the country just doesn't care. This will have a very similar impact to the hockey lockout of 04, 05, when it was like, you guys shut down the sport and nobody cared. And now you have to rebuild entirely and have a completely different sport in any way to succeed. And hockey has rebounded. Hockey completely changed, though. Hockey from 2003 to hockey in 2009 are basically two completely different sports in a lot of ways. And baseball is basically going to have to do that. And it's all self-imposed. And it's just disgusting. So let's move on and let's talk about a sport that actually does exist, which is the NBA. You have any thoughts on your Knicks at this point in time? I don't want to keep bringing up sore subjects, but
The Knicks have fallen into the very Knicks pattern of playing well enough just to lose. As in, they'll keep it close and they'll fall apart in the fourth quarter. And I think they're on like a 6-game losing streak at the time of writing here. Yeah, the only positives for the Knicks is R.J. Barrett's back from his injury, and he's the man. And kind of even opposing players, when they beat the Knicks, they'll like, in like the post game, like when they lost to the Heat, you got like Jimmy Butler saying like, "Yeah, we won, but you know, R.J. Barrett, he's the man. Hopefully he'll be the man for many years to come. I look forward to playing him. So at least you guys got that to look forward to." And yeah, that's basically the extent. And they still don't have a real point guard because Kemba Walker's knees acted. We tried to turn back the clock with that guy. It didn't work. So they don't have a real point guard. R.J. Barrett puts up a lot of points in losing efforts. And Derrick Rose had a setback, so who knows if he's even going to come back this season. So, yeah, the Knicks are Knicksing. They're still more enjoyable than like the Larry Brown era, I guess. But I don't feel compelled to watch every game as I once used to.
Oh, man. I feel so bad when I think about how you've had like Larry Brown and Phil Jackson and Tom Thibodeau and Mike D'Antoni. I'm blanking on a few others, but all these NBA royalty that have come through,
I think,
New York in the last 25 years.
Mike Brown is probably like the best. They were successful with him.
Mike Woodson?
Woodson? Coach Woodson? Yes, I'm sorry, Coach Woodson. Yes, yes. Yeah,
yeah. Coach Woodson was one of those coaches that just like screamed in New York basketball. He was the 2012, 2013, 2014 coach.
Yeah, he was the one who really got through to J.R. Smith.
Yes, yes, yes. That was still probably my favorite Knicks era that I've been alive. Bulls are currently in second. We've lost two games at this point in time. Really brutal schedule coming up. 76ers, Bucks, and even the Cavs, and I would even say even Boston are on our tails right now. We're currently 39 and 23, and there's a three-game gap between us and the Boston Celtics. So I don't know where we're going to end up. We've got Caruso. We've got Ball coming back. But, you know, I think that we are showcasing our limitations right now while still holding tough without two of our best players playing. So the next 2 to 3 weeks should be really interesting. I think it's just – it's fascinating to look at what is happening across the NBA where – Minnesota Timberwolves, the Denver Nuggets, the Dallas Mavericks are making huge pushes right now while the Lakers are falling way out. They've lost three straight. They're 3-7 in their last 10.
The Lakers Oakland are Nets. Shakespearean tragedy.
It is.
They're
impossible to watch. I really wish that they had just bit the bullet and traded LeBron at the deadline and just given him to a team that actually has a chance to win because I'm just watching him fail on the Lakers in his last couple of years of contention. It's just not fun to see. But we'll see what ends up happening here over the next couple of weeks. Like I said at the top, this is my favorite time of year to watch basketball. March, April, the push towards the playoffs, there's just so much that can happen. And you really start to see teams crystallize and form behind their stars and the rotations get really finalized.
Do the Memphis Grizzlies actually have, like, fans?
Yeah, they have a really good fan base. They are the kind of team this year, I'm honestly a little nervous for them in the playoffs because they're playing way above any past performance. I mean, you could compare them in some cases to the, like, 13-14 Randolph Gasol variety, but this is even better. And I just worry looking at them right now, they've got a first round matchup as of today with the Denver Nuggets. That's going to be a tough matchup for them. If they win that, they've got a second round matchup against probably the Golden State Warriors. That's going to be incredibly tough. If they were able to somehow pull that off, they have a pathway to the finals, but I worry that they are going to have an earlier exit than people are anticipating just because of a lack of overall experience. But we shall see. We shall see. The Bulls right now are matched up against possibly the Toronto Raptors, and that does not bode well for the Chicago Bulls.
So yesterday I was at the gym watching Ja Morant highlights because he had that incredible 50-point game, and it was synced up. I was listening to Goose and the Goose song Redbird. It's got the lyric like, when it's time for a bird to fly. And the fly part was like perfectly synced up to when Steven Adams threw the Hail Mary to Morant and he hit it at the buzzer. And I'm like, oh, perfect synergy of sports and music right there.
He also just provided a great transition because have you seen the videos coming out of Goosemas of like the and the challenges within the Goose community around singing that part of Redbird?
Like Ryan Storm stuff?
Ryan Storm did it. Okay. Our own Bruce Robinson from The Great Beyond had a great video doing it. There were videos scattered throughout the arena of people singing at that segment. It's kind of like, you know, I don't know what the exact comparable would be on the Phish side. Maybe people singing Sigma Oasis in 2020, but it's a funny little aside within the Goose community. But Goose just played their biggest show that they've ever played at the Mohegan Sun Arena, Goosemas 8. They also just started leg 2 of their tour. As of time of recording, they just played one show. As of time of release, they'll have, I think, 6 or 7 shows under their belt. But they played a really cool-looking show at the 9:30 Club. I'm halfway through set 1, really enjoyed the drive, but I'm excited to hear the Pancakes and the Wisteria Lane. Tell me your thoughts on Goosemas at this point in time.
Okay, I listened to that whole show, and it's very good. I think a very good show. not the best show that they played on the winter tour. In fact, I think I would rank it lower than some other winter tour shows. Like we were saying yesterday via text, it very much reminds me of when Phish played Madison Square Garden for the first time, December 30th, 1994. And that very solid, serviceable show, good for beginners, covers a lot of ground, but there's also better versions of the songs they played elsewhere throughout the tour. The set of Goosebumps that had me the most excited was set three, which despite only being 45 minutes, was the first three songs off of their forthcoming album Drip Feel, which comes out in June. They played the first three songs, which included debuts of the song Hundersite and the title track Drip Field. And just Drip Field is exciting because that's basically like an indie rock song. Like, there's nothing about that song that screams jam band. Like, to me, it sounds like the band Amen Dunes. It sounds a bit like the band Yesair for the 2010s. So the fact that they're so willing to improvise actual improvisation off of the indie rock format to me was very cool and exciting. And I think that song will unlock its full potential at some point and just be incredibly cool to see. So I like the fact that they use set three to kind of showcase their future, and then encore with Arcadia, which was a really good, you know, classic rah-rah movement. So overall, it was a success, I'd say.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think this is your first arena show as a band. Like, play what you know to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And I think that they did a really good job of that. I don't think that they went super deep in terms of their jamming. Honestly, one of my biggest highlights was the Nina Simone cover of Cinnamon, which I don't think that they've played all that often since releasing it on a secretly Canadian tribute record, a 25th anniversary.
They played it all. It was the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the debut of it. The jam was short, but like, it just showcased like where they go with their jamming pretty seamlessly. And I thought that that was probably my highlight up until set three. Redbird was good. Echo of a Rose was really good. You know, I think ultimately the 12-30-94 comparison, as we were talking yesterday, is really apt. They're going to have plenty of arena shows coming up. And ultimately, to me, the purpose of this show was to showcase that Goose can sound like Goose. They can still retain that sound and sound bigger in an arena. I agree with you entirely. The third set was my highlight of the overall show. Drip Field was just pretty stunning to hear live. Like, and huge, huge shout out to Jeff, who comes across just massively in Drip Field.
Yeah, Jeff.
That song was built for him.
Jeff makes his money in Drip Field.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope for the band's sake, for our sake, for Jeff's sake, that they have more of those songs in their back pocket, because having him be showcased in that way is, I think, a win for the band. Then the encore with Arcadia. I mean, it's as if Phish encored with... I know that they played You Enjoy Myself at 12:30-94, but imagine them coming out and encoring with that. Like, Arcadia is the Goose song at this point in time, and to just put that statement out there was a really... Along with Goosemas over the last weekend or so, Phish played their four-night run in Mexico. Dave, you were on HF Pod with me last Monday to break down the fourth and final night of the run. Just give me your thoughts kind of overall on the weekend and kind of some of your highlights.
It was very good. It kind of picked up the jamming style, picked up where they left off in 2021, which is to say the ability to drop large and interesting jams seemingly at will and just out of space, and using lots of space, using like the utilization, not relying so much on rage, not relying so much on being able to play many, many notes, but more so kind of just relying, I guess, upon communication and Trey's quite significant pedal board. I think also, though, you could tell that they were on the beach, which is to say it was a pretty mid-tempo set of shows. There wasn't anything raging. You didn't get the feeling that they were playing a gigantic summer shed or like a minor league hockey arena. You know, it was still overly, it was kind of laid back. Probably the peppiest night might have been night one, just because they were obviously so jacked up to get out there. You could hear really fast tempos. You could hear Phish beating the hell out of his snare. It's probably like the hardest, fastest version of I've Never Needed You Like This Before that they played. Dropping that tweezer early. Yeah, I mean, I certainly have to go back and explore it some more. Probably if I had maybe to pick a highlight the entire week, and the Wolfman's Brother from Night 3 absolutely sticks out. That was pretty fantastic. The Set Your Soul Free Set 2 opener from Night 3 gets incredibly wacky, scary, alien-esque at the end. And then the four-song second set that they did on the second night was very good. Overall, though, I think more of a four-night run for listening in the car, listening on the couch, versus listening on the elliptical machine. Whereas I listened to a ton of summer 2021 shows on the elliptical machine and got skinny.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's interesting, like, you know, we have this very unique start to the 2022 year, coming off of a really accomplished 2021, where they play this incredible summer tour. I remember you and I and our buddy Josh all being like, I don't think that they can get better for fall. Like, is this the first time that we're going to have a fall tour that's substandard to summer? And then Trey plays that incredible run with Tab that, you know, is a survival of the fittest tour and ends up with John Fishman's Almost Tab and some amazing music coming out of that. And then we move into the fall tour, which, I mean, I think we argued at the time, and I think it still holds up as the best tour that the band has played since fall 1997. It was an incredible accomplishment. And for them to come into 2022 and have a four-night run with a couple months off, a four-night run with a couple months off, an eight-night run, I believe, yeah, an eight-night run with a month off, and then a tour, it presents like this opportunity for these like minor adjustments to their sound in a way that if they were just to come back here and play a full tour wouldn't happen. So I'm curious. I definitely agree with you. There was a bit more of a mid-tempo approach, which I really liked. I wonder if that is going to carry over to MSG, or if the energy at MSG is going to mean that suddenly like the kind of noise and aggressive jamming of last summer and fall is going to dominate, or if we are really in like a full new jamming style that's like slowly evolved from last year's jamming approach. I'm really curious to find out. I'm really excited to find out. And I walked away from the weekend thinking Carini.
Haley's Comet too, I should mention. Really, really good.
Haley's Comet, Twist, Wolfman's, Set Your Soul Free, Split Open and Melt, and Golden Age were probably my favorite moments of the entire run. And from there, there's like, you know, sub favorite moments. But I think overall, it was a really strong statement from the band. And I walked away feeling like there's a lot for me to continue to dig into and try to listen to between now and MSG. And that ultimately, that's kind of the goal of this run. You don't want to walk away being like, okay, Fish played. Like, you want to walk away feeling like, all right, Fish played. Beyond that, as this is the final drop, give me a few ideas of what you have coming up musically over the next couple weeks and months, what you're looking forward to.
On St. Patrick's Day, which I didn't realize it was St. Patrick's Day at the time I bought the ticket, is I'm seeing Riley Walker with Tonstad Band. That's going to be a really fun double bill. I think it's at the Bowery Ballroom. Either Bowery Ballroom Music Hall in Lewisburg. I got to go back and look. I'm supposed to be going to all four of those MSG shows in April. I'll probably do all four. I'll definitely do three. Whether I do the last one just kind of depends on how my aging body is feeling at that point in time. I think my buddy got me a ticket to go see the British new post-punk band Squid at some point in March. I have to go. That's a band whose record I'm somewhat familiar with, but I'm told they really bring it hard on stage, so I'm interested to go to that. And on a little bit of ways away, on May 17th, Haim, a band who myself and my family love very much, is going to be playing Madison Square Garden. And provided that show goes forward and everyone is happy and healthy, I will actually, me and my wife are going to take my 7-year-old daughter to that show. She has no idea, but she loves that band.
Oh, man.
And we'll probably tell her like 2 days before, just to see her to see her flip out. So I'm really, really looking forward to that.
Oh, dude, that's so awesome. I can't wait for that.
I already booked the babysitter.
I love that. That's incredible stuff. Yeah, you know, so I saw Tone Starbond back in November and they were outstanding. They actually played at the High Dive. Blanking on the name. Yeah, maybe I'm blanking on the name of the bar. But when I saw the War on Drugs a couple weeks back, they shouted out that venue, and I was like, "Holy shit, you guys played there!" Like, I mean, it was a bar. I regrettably had to miss Riley Walker when he played out here. He played three nights across Colorado, and of reasons I had to unfortunately miss it. And so I want to give a shout out to Riley and Ryan Jewell. My sincerest apologies, my sincerest sorrow for missing those shows. I would have loved to have been there. If it had been any other weekend, I would have been there. I have His School the Messenger coming up here soon, which I'm excited about, seeing that with a couple of friends. Always a good show to kind of remind you that life is worth living. His School of the Messenger does that in concert. Steve Gunn coming up in early April, which I'm really excited about because I loved Other You. That was one of my. Sadly, I will not be seeing Garcia Peoples when they come through town. Not for lack of trying, not for lack of effort. It's my son's spring break, and we've booked a trip to Montana to take him skiing. And unfortunately, it's right over the week that Garcia Peoples will be playing in Denver, their debut in Denver after having to cancel shows 2 years ago.
They'll understand.
I'm like crestfallen. I'm so sad about this one. This is a show I've been trying to see for 3 years now. So I'm hoping that they have another tour in them, because Dodge and Dews, seeing those songs live would be incredible. Similar to you, we will be taking my son to a concert this May. We will be taking our kids to see shows like right around the same time. We actually already told him, but we got tickets for Trainastasio Band at Red Rocks. And I took him to see Billy and the Kids last summer, and we surprised him a couple weeks back and said, "You know who you're going to see in concert?" And he goes, "Who?" And we go, "Trey." And he goes, "Oh," and like got this huge smile on his face. So I figure Tab is a good entry point for the kid rather than Fish. I don't really want to do the Fish show with the kid at this point, but Tab's fun.
Tab's got the horns, Tab's
upbeat.
Good family fun.
Yeah.
If you gotta leave early, heaven forbid, you can do it.
Exactly. I can do that. Also going to see Jason Isbell at Red Rocks with Waxahachie opening up, which I can't wait for. And as of right now, I've gotten tickets to 3 of the 4 runs that I put in for Fish Summer Tour, Bethel, Hartford, and Alpine. Albeit I got Lawns, which for Alpine is basically like not getting tickets at all. But I'm still waiting on my email regarding Dix. I'm hoping I don't have to go through Ticketmaster for Dix, because I've never missed a Dix run, and I don't really want to have to consider that at this point. But, you know, it is what it is, and I'm excited to see some Fish this summer and a bunch of other music. That's the one great thing that we have going on at this point, is that live music is just back, and it's happening, and we're excited about it.
And it comes with, I used to say, God, in the middle of the pandemic, man, I'm not staying home. I'm seeing every possible show I can see once they come back. And then next week, it's like Ice Age is playing 2 nights at Bowery. And I'm like, do I really want to leave my apartment to see Ice Age? I probably should, but I don't know. So same old. I hit mail order for the Friday night Greatwood show, whatever the second man show is. I'm going to Hartford, but didn't do mail order for Hartford. And my buddy got us Bethel lawns. We'll probably try to get Pav for Bethel, but if we have to be on the lawn, no great, no big deal for Bethel. And then stuff like Jones Beach might be a game day decision. But I'll be seeing fish this year. If for some reason I get through 2022 without seeing any fish shows, something really bad happened.
Whew. Well,
Yeah.
Whew. All right. Before we jump into the big discussion of the week, and before Dave gives us any more ominous thoughts.
Ominous prophecies.
Not seeing fish this summer. As we do, and as we have been doing every week, we want to continue to recommend to you Osiris podcasts that we think are worthy of your time and your ears and are all in all incredibly well made. Dave, what do you got for us?
We always talk about Comes to Time on this show just because it's that good. So the latest Comes to Time with Uteel Burbridge and Mike Fenoya, they interview Scott Metzger. Scott Metzger is everyone's favorite laid-back, down-the-earth guitar hero. Of course, you probably know him best as singing the Bobby Weir songs and playing guitar in J-Rad, Jerusha's Almost Dead. But we find out he also has a solo record that's coming out very soon that's just him and an acoustic guitar. He's done a lot of stuff. He's been kind of like the guitarist. For those of us in the Northeast, get to see him put on like a wide variety of hats. He's been in like Chris Harford's Band of Changes. I got to know him back in the early 2000s when he was in Rana, who are a band I love a lot, who never really got their due for a variety of reasons. But it's a fun freewheeling conversation. He talks about his fiance, who his name is Katie Jacoby. She's a violin player who got to play with Roger Daltrey in The Who. He talks about that. He talks about sobriety. He regales us with some funny story of a time in New Orleans when he kind of realized that maybe sobriety is the right thing to do for me. But it's it's always a good, very pleasant, freewheeling conversation with those guys. So check out Scott Metzger, Comes to Time.
It's a great conversation, and I would encourage anyone out there who has listened to Comes to Time as a result of our recommendations to continue doing so. It's such an excellent, excellent podcast. I'm going to recommend another excellent podcast on Osiris that I've talked about before, but I can't stop listening to, and that is Inside the Musician's Brain. Chris Pandolfi, the banjo player for the infamous String Dusters, hosts the show that deep dives into, as the title suggests, the musician's brains. What is it? What is happening inside of a musician as they're playing music, as they're crafting music, as they're writing music, as they're playing live? This episode is really, really special. He has all five members of the String Dusters on to talk about their new album, Toward the Fray. They go track by track through the record. They give behind-the-scenes insights into the songwriting process, talking about what it was like to write over Zoom and what it was like to record this record in the middle of the pandemic. It's a fascinating conversation. It is something that I am, you know, the older I get, the more I listen to bands within this jam band sphere, the more fascinated I am about how these bands figure out a way to communicate this music that they present in a live format that is ultimately the draw in a studio, and the challenges that are posed and the ambitions that people have. The String Dusters are a Grammy-nominated, Grammy Award-winning band. Like, they've done really good work in the studio, and hearing them approach a studio album at this stage in their career with the pandemic swirling all around them is really fascinating insight. So I highly recommend it, Inside the Musician's Brain on the infamous String Dusters. So as we said at the top of the episode, this will be the final episode of the Dave and Brian Led the Drop. We are going to take a step back. We may be back here sooner than you think with another project, but we are going to take a step back from the weekly show, and we are handing the reins over to the incredible Karina Reichman and Isaac Sloan, who are going to be debuting a show here on Osiris Media at the end of March called Inappropriate Happiness. It is going to be a fascinating weekly gig taking over the drop feed here, talking about live music that they're seeing, Karina's touring experiences, music they're listening to, what's happening locally in New York City, and just kind of their takes on music, as well as recommendations of albums that you should check out and recommendations of Osiris Media. We're going to go ahead here and play the trailer for Inappropriate Happiness for you right now, so that you are able to get a sense of what the show is going to be like and look forward to Inappropriate Happiness with Karina Reichman and Isaac Sloan. Enjoy.
Osiris.
Oh, hey, Karina. You got some news?
Oh, I've got news. Hi. I'm Karina Reichman.
And I'm Isaac Sloan.
And we are so thrilled to announce our brand new podcast on the Osiris Media Network.
It is a new weekly show where we highlight who's on the road, what's coming out, and all things live music.
As well as our current exploits, adventures, and general lunacy.
It's going to be like a fat dose of unbridled hilarity.
It's for all of you out there, like us, who find themselves overwhelmingly compelled by the power of music. And we cannot wait to share it with you. It's coming out soon on Osiris Media, and we can't wait to talk to each other.
We're going to talk to each other every week.
Every week, and you're going to be able to listen if you care to. You don't have to, but it's there for public consumption, so think about it. And he's a funny guy.
Oh, come on. Karina Reichman?
Isaac Sloan?
The realest in the game.
Unbelievable. He loves to type.
He loves to type.
And look, I love to tap.
No. Absolutely not. I don't kill my own spiders.
Osiris.
All right, so we found it only fitting for our last episode of The Drop here to focus entirely on a band that I don't want to say we discovered, but we got hip to during our first run of podcasts back in 2017, when we were informed of their second album, Go Farther in Lightness, which hit us both like a ton of bricks and ended up very high on our top albums list of 2017. I think it was number 2 for me. Forget where it was for you, but it was very high up on our top albums list.
It was top 5, I forget where. Definitely top 5.
Top 5, yeah. After just being released like towards the end of October, I think that we both heard it for the first time.
I remember exactly where I was when I heard that Gang of Youth record. When I heard that Gang of Youth record, I was at my old apartment, and it was at night, and I was walking to take the rent and put the rent in the slot of the building that my old apartment complex did. And I just had it on my headphones, and the first song came on, and I said, "Whoa, this is like Japandroids, but Springsteen. Springsteen Japandroids." And the second song came on. It was even better than the first song.
Yeah, I remember you sent it to me and you were like, you should turn this up. And it was right before we were recording an episode. And whatever new album I was going to talk about, I said, fuck it, I'm talking about this record. And my thought on the first track was, this is Japan Droids playing Jungle Land.
Yeah.
This is like one of the greatest things I've ever heard. And that record I listened to constantly. And I thought I was hearing like the future of indie rock, because you got Japan Droids in a couple songs. You got The National in a couple songs. You got Broken Social Scene. You got the Springsteen vibe. You got Arcade Fire. If Arcade Fire had never started sucking, you got all these elements of music that I just loved in as pure a way as possible, to the point that like when I was listening to it, I was like, is this too on the nose for me? And then was like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those records where it's like, this is so much my shit, you get like suspicious.
Right. Who's reading my fucking algorithms and making music based off of it, and why? We loved that record. The band had some challenges from that record, namely, I forget what happened specifically, but they were planning to tour in the United States, and I know that they canceled the show in DC that I was going to go to, like really, really close to the show time, to the point that I was kind of like, this is not a good way to run a band that is trying to grow. No new music came in 2018. No new music came in 2019.
Well, didn't they have to cancel a bunch of dates because of the front man, his voice? Like, he was losing it, I thought.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Which I was just like, okay, like, this is something that should be dealt with a little bit better internally. It felt to me like it felt like a very strange reason to go ahead and have to cancel shows, but then continue to play other shows.
Right.
But no new music in 2018 or 2019, which you would have thought coming out of Go Farther and Lightness that the band would have turned around immediately and put out another record. Nothing in 2020. Obviously, we've got the pandemic. I remember being concerned, is this band going to be able to last? Because they have one record, and who knows? Like, you know, videos of them playing are to either really packed rooms in London and Australia, or sparse daytime festival sets where Dave Le Papou is giving literally everything that he has to nobody. They announced at some point in 2021 that their third record, Angel in Real Time, was coming out here in early 2022. It was released about 2 weeks ago, and we have listened to it a number of times, and we have thoughts. Dave, tell me your thoughts on Angel in Real Time and kind of where Gang of Youths is at in early 2022.
Well, I was a bit suspicious leading up to Angel in Real Time, because I think the first thing the band actually put out was they put out a 3-song EP, I think in the middle of 2021, with 3 non-album tracks. Well, actually, no. I believe one of the tracks was the third song on the record, called Angel of 8th Avenue. That was the very first single. That EP also had a cover of the song Asleep in the Back by the band Elbow. I think one other non-album track, which escapes me. That was followed by, I think they released 5 other singles leading up to the album. So when the album came out, they had already put out about a little more than 1/3 of the record. And not one of those singles really got me that excited for it. I thought, this album could be a mistake. Something's not really clicking here. Maybe these songs will sound better in the context of a record. But to me, it's kind of like a weird red flag when there's that many pre-release singles. I mean, it's interesting. It's a predicament similar to when the War on Drugs had their big breakthrough with Lost in the Dream. And then for the follow-up, A Deeper Understanding, they had like 5 or 6 singles before the record came out. And I was asking, like, why is he doing this? Is he just like the record company, or is this Adam Grant show, like, hedging his bets? Like, I didn't really know. So when I first got to hear all of Angel in Real Time, to be honest, I kind of hated it, because it's very It's a very produced album. It's a very personal album, as in all the press, in all the interviews, everything in the run-up. This album is about Dave, the frontman, Dave LaPape's father, who died, I think, in 2018, and how upon his death he came to find out that his father had this basically this entire, was older than he thought, and had a whole secret life involving two brothers, two half-brothers that he had no idea that he had. And the father basically had to live with this kind of this shame his whole life. This, I mean, I guess there's like an alternate universe where Gang of Youth's album number 3, he never finds out about this father and none of the record is about this. But it ends up being, the lyrics are incredibly literal to the point where it almost feels like Broadway show tunes, because the lyrics, there's lyrics about his father's upbringing, about his father's death. There's lyrics, there's a song about him, Dave discovering his wife in New York, then going back to London. There's a song called Brothers, which is like a Sun Kill a Moon song. It's just basically narrative. And this album, it's such that the production is so, there's so many samples, so many strings, and so many different things in addition to the songs themselves that I really thought it got in the way at first. But the more I listen to the record, it seems like he put so much effort into it, and it's such a personal project that I kind of feel like a jerk hating on it. And the songwriting's still there. Like, the songwriting exists. Whether, and the big question for my longevity is whether or not I can wrap my head around the production enough to get to the heart of the songs. And the jury is still out on that. What say you?
I'm in a really similar boat with you. I mean, the thing that appealed to me the most about, well, I'd say the two things that appealed to me the most about Gang of Youths when I heard Go Farther in Lightness was that, you know, musical combination of so many elements of music that I just absolutely love. And if you go back to 2017 and you think about the big records of that year, there are a lot of bands that had already made a claim to indie rock that were returning and putting out really quality records. National, The War on Drugs, Fleet Foxes, Grizzly Bear, LCD Sound System. 2017 is littered, Spoon even, with bands that had made great records in the previous decade and a half in the indie, in the sprawling indie rock world, and were returning with really, really quality statements. And then you get this Gang of Youth's record, and it felt to me in the moment of hearing it that we've got the bridge going forward. We keep being told by the music press that the album is dead. We keep being told that rock music is kind of becoming a subgenre of itself, that it doesn't really have the ability to, you know, really enrapture and bring in listeners in the way that it did even 10 years earlier, even 5 years earlier. You know, we get these bands like Imagine Dragons or the Chainsmokers that are, you know, posing as rock bands, but let's be real, like it's, you know, corporate branding with a guitar type of thing. And Gang of Youth felt like a band in a way that I've always loved a band. And so I was willing to forgive a lot of things that, like, you know, seemed like strange diversions from a band's progression, because they seem to be going through a lot of shit. They seem to have exploded in a way that is reminiscent of mid-2000s indie rock bands, where like you explode with hype and you explode with cultural cachet, but that doesn't necessarily translate into financial gains. So it's still really hard for bands to exist. You think almost like a Clap Your Hands Say Yeah that like was everywhere in 2005, but like did Clap Your Hands Say Yeah really end up making like the money that they could have made had they come out in the 1990s? So all this is to say, like, going into this record, I had really high expectations. And the first time I heard it, I fucking hated it. I felt the exact same way as you did. It felt glossy. It felt like we were seeing a kind of blatant, and I can't fault them for this, but like a blatant attempt at becoming a Coldplay. And I agree with you, though. The more I listen to this record, the more I consider this record, the more I considered what Dave was singing about, the more I kind of stepped back from my initial criticism and really felt myself diving into the lyrical depths of this album and like the personal aspects. And you talk about the song Brothers, like that's totally, that could have come off of Benji from Sun Kill Moon in 2014, one of my favorite records of the last 10 years, regardless of the fact that Mark Kozlik is a piece of shit. I think ultimately the challenge that I find with this record and with where this band is at the time is not necessarily that I wish the alternate history had happened and we got a different Gang of Youth record, but I kind of wish we had had a record that bridged Go Farther in Lightness to this. I would love to know what Dave was writing in 2017, early 2018, before all this happened. And I'm also curious like where we go from here, because this feels very much like a Dave record regardless who's behind him, whereas Go Farther in Lightness very much felt like a band record with this incredibly compelling lead singer. So that question, I think, still remains and still lingers. I also think the biggest fault I think I could put on this record is the production feels grandiose for the sake of being grandiose rather than for the sake of what it needs. And that is a technique that strikes me as that's something I hope that they avoid going forward. They're obviously a very big band. They want to be the biggest sounding band in the world. They want to be the biggest band that you've ever heard. That seems to be their ambitions. But I do worry that we're going to just get these big hooks and choruses and maximalization moments for the sake of it rather than for the need of the music. Does that make sense? Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I do agree with. I think he's obviously a guy who feels the feelings. Like I saw them on the Go Farther and Lightness tour. I saw them at Barry Barham, which holds 500 people. It was like 400 people. It wasn't sold out, but it was very full. And despite, I think he was only maybe 25 years old at the time, only his second record, but in between each song, there was like a 3 to 4 minute like Springsteen style soliloquy. Like it would have been like Springsteen. Every song was like Springsteen, like kind of like talking about like a song from like Nebraska, like him getting up there and doing like a monologue before playing like Atlantic City. And I thought like, okay, you know, that's how it is. I realize you care a lot about the lyrics and you care about your place in rock history. And obviously you like a lot of the same bands I do. So if you want to like regale us with the story behind every song, that's fine. And then you can see that now in a Stereogum interview with the writer Chris DeVille. He goes track by track every song of the new record, and every song is like four paragraphs. And I read through the whole thing, and I'm like, you know, this is, you have every right to do this and put your heart and soul into it. And like you said, I mean, one of the problems I have is that, like, Go Farther in Lightness felt like dudes in a room, where this album feels like a Dave solo project as played by a Gang of Utes. And that's evident in the mountains of strings, orchestras that's on every song, the dated breakbeats on a bunch of songs. I know he samples indigenous peoples from the Cook Islands and Samoa. They sing on a whole bunch of the songs. Like some songs, there's as many as like, it sounds like five or six different tracks going on aside from the band playing. And I just want to say, you needed an editor. And maybe you had an editor. Like, of course, Neil Young always had David Briggs to kind of curb his flights of fancy. U2 had Len Wah and Eno. Game of David LaPape needs his David Briggs to say, like, I see what you're trying to do here. I get it, I understand it, but it will serve the song better if you don't have the strings and the samples and the breakbeats that sonic through from 1999. I think ultimately the songwriting is strong enough that I'm getting around it. I mean, I think it's fascinating how he puts in references to like the EPL in soccer and other sporting events and elements of like Australian history. Like you could really go to town of like, what's the website Genius that people like dissect the lyrics. They go like line by line, like annotate. You could really dig down deep into it. And for that, it's earned itself repeated plays. But I assume that there's an alternate universe with a remix that makes a better record.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point because, like, you know, we talked about this alternate history of, like, what happened to Dave in 2018 doesn't happen and we get the follow-up to Go Farther in Lightness. And I think one important, like, caveat to that is what Dave was singing about in Go Farther in Lightness, I mean, he put every single emotion and feeling and thought into that, regardless if anything significant had really happened in his life at that point in time. Like every relationship, every breakup, every dead end, every fork in the road of his life was the most important thing that had ever happened to anyone. So I think regardless what he wrote about in a potential alternate history was going to have the kind of lyrical depths that we get here when like something like this happens. I mean, just imagine, you know, you're not a songwriter. Your father passes away and you find out that your father had a completely alternate life. Like that's going to completely reshape your entire worldview and your entire way of thinking. And the fact that he can pour that into song in the way that he did is super impressive. And it is something that I think is the strongest aspect of this. I think one point that you make that I think we're both in agreement with fully and is my biggest question for this band going forward is Go Farther in Lightness sounded timeless in its ability to take all these different elements of classic rock and indie rock history and apply them into this stew in 2017 that both sounded like a record that came out in 2017, but also was like, this could have come out in 1976. This could have come out in 2007. Who knows? It just like, it existed. And I put that record on and it never sounds dated. The music on Angel in Real Time sounds like music that could have only come out in like 2010, 2011, 2012. It really strikes me as like the Lumineers, Mumford & Sons, this archaic mix of old world indie folk with samples and layering for just the sake of samples and layering, just so that you hear that like in the back and like, you know, like behind you and, you know, break beats and stuff, like all these little sounds that are literally just there to hear those sounds. And it's a lot of unnecessary subtraction by addition, if you will. I feel like it takes away from the record the amount of cacophony noise that I hear that just, it feels very dated and it just doesn't feel necessary. And I agree with you. I think that an editor would have helped out significantly here.
I would even go back as far as like 1999 when it was like rock was mating with electronica and you had like
totally
that like Uncle record with James Lavelle and Tom York, Rabbit in Your Headlights, that type of thing where music critics are like, this is an electronica album, but it's really the best rock album of the year. Like, I think, oh God, what is, I don't, all the song titles in this record, they're all like lowercase. They all kind of run together. I think it's maybe the fourth song called Returner, where there's just stacks up samples and beats and he's talking about, he's like saying, I'm only in it for the money, which I guess he claimed is about how people thought it was weird that he still toured after his father died because he still had the support of family. And I think, okay, that's what that's about. All right, that's fine. But it's, I have to skip that song. I hate that song. But the rest of the album could eventually be okay. But the reason that, I mean, the fact that we're talking about it this much, we definitely recommend you listen, make your own judgments. We will always recommend the second and the first Gang of Youths record. But number three, they're taking a big swing. I'm curious to see if I'm still listening to it 3-4 weeks from now. But you guys should check it out.
right. So, as we have been doing here on The Drop since we retook over this show back in July, and for the last time to date, we'll be marching back in time to a year that I think we both struggled a little bit to figure out, okay, what are we going to feature here? And then it all kind of clicked and it made sense because the year is 1982. Ronald Reagan is still battling a recession. The Cold War is about to enter a new phase. Music is changing. The music of 1982 sounds significantly different from the music just 2 and 4 years earlier. The Los Angeles Lakers are about to win a championship before challenges are going to unfold on the team as they move into the mid part of the 1980s and start to battle the Boston Celtics. What else is happening in 1982? Who won the World Series in 1982?
Can't remember.
Dodgers won in 81.
Right.
The Orioles won in 83. I believe it was the St. Louis Cardinals in 82 beating the Milwaukee Brewers. 7-game series.
That would make sense.
The Islanders had to win the Stanley Cup in 82, right?
Oh, yeah. The Islanders had the most incredible run in the 80s, and they won it like 4 years in a row. The Nystrom era might have been like 83, 84. The Islanders were in fuego in the early 80s.
The Washington football team, now Commanders, previously a name that we will not say on this podcast, won the Super Bowl against the Miami Dolphins. I'm just giving you all 1982 news that I know. Dave, where were you at? And just before I ask that, the two artists we're going to talk about here are going in very different directions in 1982, which we will showcase here. But Dave, where were you at in 1982? What do you recall about that year, and what is the album you're going to share with us?
I was 3, so I don't recall that much. We're living in a house on the north end of Cheshire, Connecticut, on a street called Creamery Road. Ostensibly, there was a creamery there at one time. I remember playing in the backyard, and the backyard kind of had a bit of a hill, so I would go sideways, I would roll down the hill. There was a big weeping willow tree in the backyard. My best friend was my next-door neighbor, Jonathan Zekin, who I have not heard from in several years. My sister was born in 1982. She was born on November 3rd, 1982, so we are 3 years apart, as I was born in September 1979. I remember going to see her in the hospital and having a copy of The Little Blue Engine That Could. So maybe I remember a lot more about 1982 than I had initially thought. I do recall my parents had the record I'm going to talk about on vinyl. That is John Mellencamp, who in 1982 went by the name John Cougar. Not John Cougar Mellencamp, just John Cougar. And he actually put out his 5th album called American Fool. Now, 1982 is an interesting year in that there's many records that I kind of know bits and pieces of, but the only one I really feel strongly about is Rush's Signals, and I think I spoke about Rush in the podcast last week, so I don't want to do it again. But American Fool is interesting to me because everyone knows Hurt So Good and Jack and Diane. If they listen to any rock radio station in the past 40-some-odd years, those songs still get played as much as they got played in 1982. It's just like undeniable American Heartland classics. I was thinking to myself, you know, I don't think I've ever listened to that album in full beyond those 2 songs. I know my parents had it. I remember seeing the vinyl cover and know that those 2 songs were on it, but I figured, all right, let's change that. For this episode of The Drop, I will listen to all of American Fool. And I did so over the past 2 days. And it's funny how kind of all the chords that are used on that record are used in the first 2 songs. It's kind of funny how few chords the album has. It's almost like the Stooges' Funhouse, and that it's basically just the same 3 chords, only the accents differing throughout the album. But it's a very solid collection of radio-friendly Heartland rock and roll. Nearly every song could be a single. It's pretty agreeable. He's very fond of album song titles becoming choruses. Like, we're gonna listen to the bit of the song called Thundering Hearts, and the phrase Thundering Hearts is yelled out at the chorus. It actually doesn't sound very dated. It doesn't have a lot of synths. It doesn't have, outside of a bit of a gating effect in Kenny Aronoff's drums, it's aged surprisingly well. I put on this record, I kind of want to be sitting on the front of a pickup truck on a field in Indiana, drinking a long neck, kind of living out my like Midwest 80s fantasies. So, solid record from a man who had an incredibly solid and still ongoing career. He just put out an album. Let's listen to a bit of Thunder and Hearts off of John Cougar's American Fool album.
So, I was listening to, one of the things I like about Apple Music is that you can see directly what your friends are listening to, and if multiple friends are listening to the same album that you follow on Apple Music, you get, like, really promoted a record, and for whatever reason, both you and Matt Dwyer were listening to John Cougar's American Fool in the last week, so, like, that record keeps popping up as an album I need to listen to. So, I listened to it again.
Hey, Dwyer.
And, yeah, it's a really great record. I went in there. Apple Music also has access where you can watch music videos instead of just listening to the songs. And the opening track, Hurt So Good, has one of the like very, very clear John Cougar statement music videos. And it's a small town in Indiana as having just like streets shut down. Nobody's working except for the bartenders. And this party in a dive bar, and there are women in fishnets and chains and black dresses up on the bar, and John Cougar dancing with them and then jumping down with the bikers, putting his arms around them and singing the chorus of Hurt So Good. And I was watching it and I was thinking, you know, my parents used to videotape music videos of artists that they loved. And we would have like these VHS collections of music videos from the 1980s. And I would just put them on as a kid and watch them. And I have no idea how they allowed me to watch. Things just went over my head when I was a kid watching this stuff. But I have no idea how they allowed me to watch it because it is scandalous stuff. But really, really great record.
If you want scandalous, go to Genius and look up the lyrics to Jack and Diane. It's like the funniest. Well, I mean, it talks about how the song was originally supposed to be about an interracial couple, which I think I knew, but the record label pressured John Mellencamp to change the Jack character from being African-American to being a football star, which I guess he did so reluctantly. But even beyond that, it's the Genius entries are very, very funny. That's all. It should be funny.
I love it. I don't have any memories of 1982 aside from all the sports stuff that I listed off because I was not alive at that point. My parents got married on April 3rd, 1982. So happy 40th anniversary in a couple weeks to Jim and Nancy Brinkman. I'm going to talk about a record from, I said we were talking about artists who went in two very divergent directions after 1982. John Cougar's American Fool was his breakthrough. The man became a star after that. I want to talk about Richard and Linda Thompson's Shoot Out the Lights, the sixth and final record for Richard and Linda Thompson. Many would say that their best work came in the mid-1970s. 1982 Shoot Out the Lights is an absolute classic, one of my favorite records to listen to. Late and an incredible statement from the two artists. Yeah, and this record came on the heels of 1979's Sunny Vista, which sold poorly, and they did not have a record deal. They toured in support of Gary Rafferty in 1980. did some demo tracks, and they had no contract in 1980-1981, but they were able to secure a loan to record the record in the fall of 1980. There's a lot of tension between Jerry Rafferty and Richard Thompson, Jerry Rafferty who helped finance the record, as well as between Richard and Linda, and this would prove to be their final record that they would make together. It's a pretty perfect album, though. It showcases both Richard and Linda on an individual basis as just incredible songwriters, singers to their own right, but also kind of the faltering and the withering of a relationship. We're going to play a bit of Backstreet Slide, which is like just a classic Richard Thompson groove and stomp, and it's an incredible moment on the record halfway through to give us just kind of an insight into where he's at from a lyrical standpoint as well as musically where he would take much of his career going forward. This is just one of the records that I keep going back to from this time in rock history. I love the way that it sounds like it could have come from the mid-1970s, but it has production qualities of the 1980s. I'm a stickler for, you know, records that feel in some cases like they were laborious, they were torturous, and this record feels like it was torture in a lot of cases. Hail Mary in a lot of ways for the band, for the two artists, and somehow magic is found from within. So we're going to play a little bit off of Richard and Linda Thompson's song Backstreets.
What you say, you turn your back and they slide away. They run next door, they give it all away. Doing the slide, there's the back street slide, the back street slide. They're gonna get you, dead or alive. Stab you in the back with a kitchen knife. Doing the back street slide.
All right. And with that, we're going to tip our cap to you, our fair listener. Thank you so much for every one of you out there who have listened to us over the last few months as we have hosted the drop here. Thank you for your support. Thank you for those of you who have retweeted and shared our episodes and offered feedback and thoughts. Thanks to our guests that we've had. Specifically, Scotty King, Tim Showalter. You guys were all incredible guests on the show here over the last couple of months.
Mike Gelman,
Dad Rock, etc. We hope to be back in some form. Keep an eye out on your Twitter feed for a potential announcement here in the near future. Dave, it's been a ton of fun to continue to host podcasts with you, and I hope that we're able to do this here going forward.
Always. I very much enjoyed doing the drop for the last 9 months or so. Very much enjoyed getting out to the people. If you've been listening this far, thank you very much for doing so. And like Brian says, this is not necessarily the end. It's, I would say, watch your Twitter feed. We're going to see what comes. We have some other ideas, other ways to keep the podcast spirit alive because we've been doing it for too long to stop now. But at least for the time being, we're going to take a step back.
And another
next
step
week,
back.
We're not going to hold hands. And another step back. What do you mean, no? And then I start playing Scarlet Begonias. We'll not be singing Kumbaya next week, but you will be in excellent hands with our replacement. Thank you for listening to The Drop.
Osiris.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the corner of Gray Street.